The earthy smell of wet clay hangs in the air around a group of young boys and girls, perhaps 10 or 11 years old, and they're enjoying their afternoon in the not too hot months at the end of the year in Cambodia. They live in a relatively small village in Takeo province, forming a large territory to the south of Phnom Penh and connected to the part of southern Vietnam around the Mekong Delta. Amongst the odd palm tree and the familiar grid-like pattern of shapes formed by the rice paddies surrounding the village, the young group take turns with a makeshift fishing rod or bucket, catching the small fish and crabs which seem to abound in any river or body of water in the kingdom, big or small. Mud and grass between their toes, they laugh and jostle, and yell out whenever someone manages to pluck something slippery out of the water. And in amongst the smell of the heat of the water, as well as the pleasant lingering of smoke from some number of small fires, heating stoves, or the sweet and sour aromas of simmering soup, there was something else, something distinct. Every now and again, the breeze which was caressing this pond near the village would elect to carry a violent smell, an odour which is difficult to describe to someone who has not experienced it. But think old meat left to rot in the sun, plus just a dash of cheap perfume. Or is some vast amount of sewage, but accompanied by this extra density, heft to the smell. One of the boys dives out of the way of a clump of mud that was playfully thrown in his direction, and finds himself getting back to his feet next to a mess of wet black hair connected to a pallid, expressionless face. The face was half submerged in the water and sitting in some kind of aquatic weed, the result of a decapitation at the hands of local Khmer Issarak, the large banner that many independence fighters considered themselves fighting under. The boy, relatively unperturbed by this now semi-routine occasion, simply pulls the head up by its hair and casts it aside. The fact that this ghastly sight was not something that would ruin the day of the young boy. Well, this was a result of the continuing years of war that had now begun claiming large areas of Cambodia, a country now firmly playing a role within the First Indochina War. This was the violent struggle the French had begun against a host of independence movements across the region. It had claimed as French Indochina. This had become a long and brutal conflict. It was now being referred to more and more commonly in France as La Sale Guerre, the Dirty War. Although Cambodia had seen just a fraction of the fighting and bloodshed that neighbouring Vietnam was experiencing, by 1953, the struggle between different anti-government movements, collectively referred to as the Khmer Issarak, as well as the growing role of a Cambodian offshoot of the Viet Minh, was certainly producing its fair share of brutality and horror. Slowly, a status quo similar to that of Vietnam, with its archipelago of expanding and contracting areas that changed hands between government forces or those seeking to establish a revolutionary counterstate, began to colour the map of Cambodia. We looked at this in the last episode as well, but this war was as much about controlling areas of people themselves as it was to do with military engagements between the various belligerents. You have this scenario for years at this point, where the people who comprised the villages and provinces and lived off of the land, which was changing hands between these competing forces, well, you can imagine the kind of disruption to their lives. But more than that, someone could easily be accused by either side of working with the Issarak or the French, and this could be a death sentence. Bunchan Mol, one of the founders of the Issarak movement in the mid-1940s, he recalled a situation that illustrates this sad and widespread result of the war. Quote, "If we thought a Cambodian was spying for the French, we tortured him and then killed him. If the executioner clubbed him to death cleanly with a blow on the back of the neck, it was not so hard to look at. But sometimes they used other means. They had a method called Sran Yapien. First they beat up the suspect. Then they made him kneel beside an open grave with his hands tied behind his back and formed a circle around him. The executioner took a sharp sword and started dancing around the man and making horrible grimaces. He gradually got closer and very slowly started cutting the man's throat, sucking the blood as it came out, and spewing it onto the blade of the sword. It was terrible to see. The victim shook with pain, until finally the killer slashed his throat and pushed him into the grave. I was against that way of doing things, but the other Issarak leaders didn't agree with me. They said the suspect has to be killed like that as a warning to people not to work for the French." End quote. But this rather elaborate method of inducing fear into local populations was not the only way. In Philip Short's biography of Pol Pot, he describes other scenes of violence as well as the justification for it. Some of those accused of this kind of treachery and collusion with the French had their bellies ripped open while they were still alive, then their livers torn out to be fried and eaten by their accusers. In some Southeast Asian contexts, the liver can be viewed, or imbued, perhaps I should say, with the kind of metaphorical energy that a Western mind might consider someone's heart. You know, you might say someone is strong-hearted, or they have a big heart. Well, in a Cambodian context, to say someone was courageous or brave, you might say they have a lot of liver. And thus, the cannibalization of someone's liver, in this instance, would be thought to impart the man's strength into the person who ate it. This superstitious violence in the war in Cambodia also reminds us of the kind of magical amulets that were sought after, like the Khun Krak, or smoke children we discussed previously, or the way in which some warlords were also feared because of the kind of supernatural powers that they were thought to employ. And if it sounds like I'm perhaps focusing on the excesses of the Issarak too much, then please allow me to balance the books, if that's an appropriate phrase. All the factions in this conflict were breaking rules and committing what we would easily consider war crimes. Colonial troops raped women, burned down villages, and destroyed harvests, in the words of Philip Short, who also notes that a former Cambodian government soldier described how in Battambang province, he and his fellow troops would move into villages, kill the men and women who had not already fled, and then engage in individual tests of strength, which consisted of grasping infants by the legs and pulling them apart. The Khmer Viet Minh were not much better The Cambodian leader of the faction routinely informed his Vietnamese superiors that an enemy agent had been detained, but, quote, despite the tortures we have inflicted on him, he refuses to talk. And it wasn't just government troops that were guilty of village-wide destruction. French officials complained that when their forces moved out of a village that they had been protecting, well, the communists moved in immediately, burned it down in reprisal. In disputed areas, Viet Minh assassination squads were sent to murder their political opponents. So it is this kind of backdrop, I guess we could say, where a group of boys enjoying their afternoon fishing might casually see a severed head. Something that had become a normality in their lives. And that could vary wildly depending on where you were living in the country. I mean, a couple of episodes ago we touched on the personal fiefdom of a magical warlord like Dap Chuan in and around the region of Siem Reap. Now, the former sergeant, of course, defecting to the government in 1952 in exchange for that whole area to remain under his control. But around the country, there were other Issarak warlords in charge. Some other provinces, however, were coming under the control of the Khmer Viet Minh and its Cambodian leader, Son Nhoc Minh. Not to be confused with Son Nhoc Thanh, the famous Cambodian nationalist who had also fled to the jungles, joining the Maquis, as it was called, to build a kind of resistance movement of his own. So we have all of these areas that are now considered insecure by the French authorities. No-go zones, where now perhaps hundreds of thousands, maybe even a million Cambodians, were out of reach of the government, with some significant portion of that under communist rule. And this is bad for business, you know. Like, this takes a huge economic toll for the government and the interests of the French in the region. You can't collect taxes or any cash crops like rubber, which may have been in those territories that you've lost to revolutionaries, to bandits, to communists, to radical nationalists. Not looking good. In previous episodes, I've tried to establish this war across Indochina as fairly unconventional, in the sense that it was about trying to set up these proto-states in opposition to a colonial power who was as well trying to simply cement its dominance and its own versions of how these so-called incorporated Indochinese states should operate. We could describe this as the, you know, official countries on the map in the eyes of the French and their supporters, and the unofficial ghost territories that existed alongside or beneath them and were run by those who were violently opposed to French rule. But there are genuine military clashes as well. So I will, you know, relate a situation which I think showcases a typical Cambodian exchange in the First Indochina War. Again, this is from Philip Short and is a description of an encounter between government forces, a patrol of around 50 men, ambushed by Viet Minh in Kampong Cham in January of 1953. And the regimental dispatch recounts what happened. Quote, in the first burst of machine gun fire, Sergeant Roang received a bullet in the head and was killed outright. Corporal Reck, mortally wounded, crawled back toward our main force. Sub-Lieutenant Chim Yan ran forward to recover Sergeant Roang's rifle and took cover behind an anthill, when he too was hit by a bullet in the head. Seeing that the situation was critical, our men counterattacked. Four Viet Minh fell under our fire. Our men then formed a square. Towards 17:30 hours, the Viets approached from the southeast. They called out to our men, "Don't shoot, we are your friends." Then they charged. Most of their fighters did not have firearms. They just ran toward us in a compact mass, yelling. We cut them down with machine gun fire and grenades. Their shouts suddenly stopped as though their throats had been cut. The battle ended at nightfall, and our men marched back, reaching headquarters at 2 a.m. End quote. I've said in the past that this isn't a military history podcast, but there is a reason why I am emphasizing the violence here, and why I began this intro with the story about the boys fishing and finding the severed head. Cambodia by the early 1950s has been fully pulled into the First Indochina War, and everything is being affected by this. The way that it must be necessarily fought in and amongst the civilian populations, and that the armies for all the factions fighting had to constantly work at keeping the territory they had claimed under their control. The war wasn't happening in any one place, but in a sense covered all three territories of Indochina, and the prospects of some fundamental change in this situation seemed distant. We would also do well to remember the kinds of psychological impact that this kind of fighting and violence could have on a society in the long term. Now, you might recall at the end of the last episode, there was a group of Cambodian students who were studying in Paris at this time, in the early 1950s. They had become increasingly engaged in political questions of the day, and many had seen communism as a means to achieve independence for their country. They called themselves the Cercle Marxiste, the Marxist Circle, and they were very interested in which factions were doing better or worse in this struggle against the French. Was it the Cambodians who had joined the Viet Minh? Was it Issarak leaders like the rebel Prince Chantarangzi? Or what about the former Prime Minister, Sonyok Tan, the nationalist hero who had returned to Phnom Penh and attempted to rally a sizable backing in the forests? The members of the circle had sent a couple of their own back to Cambodia to investigate and report back to them. And one of the most dedicated revolutionaries who had volunteered was none other than Salot Sar. The man that would one day adopt the name Pol Pot arrived back in Cambodia in January of 1953. The country, as we've discussed, now completely engulfed in this struggle, was rather different to the one that he had left behind just over 3 years earlier. And what about the young king who had bestowed upon Salot Sar an envelope of money and a blessing to study in Paris with a group of other graduates from a trade school in Phnom Penh? Well, the king too had changed quite a bit in these 3 years, much less the playboy who remained aloof of politics, and more the authoritarian Deva Raja who had taken steps to dismantle the political process in his country, and was now ruling by decree. Sihanouk was going to try and achieve independence by his own means, and in this episode, we will follow the path that he takes on his self-proclaimed royal crusade for independence, as well as the path that Salot Sar takes toward becoming a revolutionary. The backdrop of this episode is war and suffering, and the paths that some hope to navigate away from this state of violence will, unfortunately, eventually, produce the same miserable outcome in greater orders of magnitude. Salot Sar disembarked the SS Jamaica in Saigon on January 13th, 1953. Both he and his country's circumstances had changed quite a bit since he had taken that same ship to France at the end of 1949. For instance, He couldn't simply purchase a ticket for a bus back to Phnom Penh. Now there was a single convoy that would make that journey once a day, one that would necessarily bring with it a military escort in order to safely traverse the numerous areas of Vietnam and Cambodia, whose roads were not considered safe from Viet Minh or Isarak ambush. Upon arriving back in his home village of Prek Spao, Kampong Tong province, around about 100 miles north of Phnom Penh, the reality of the country being a war zone set in for him. He recalled, quote, "Before I went away to study, my relatives were mostly middle-class farmers. When I returned, I took a bus home, and at the terminal someone, one of the rickshaw drivers, called out to me, 'Oh, you're back.' I looked and it was one of my uncles. He asked me, 'Do you want to ride home?' I was so shocked. That man used to have land, buffaloes, everything. I wept to see him like that. I rode home with him, and over the next month or so, I talked with other relatives who had also lost everything. The Cambodian countryside was being turned to poverty. Having lived in Europe, seeing these things hurt my heart." End quote. So here we see some of the fragilities, maybe, I guess we could say, of the economic framework of the Cambodian countryside. If we recall our discussion of the village called Svai in episode 7, remember the difference between wealth and deprivation in rural areas of Cambodia. This could come down to the amount of rice paddies that you owned and could cultivate, or how many work animals you had. Many were simply subsistence farmers getting by season to season. So think how detrimental it could be if rice stores were requisitioned by one faction or another, or if animals or family members were targeted by banditry without the protection of local officials, who would have usually provided some, you know, protection in return for taxes, grain, or some other form of debt. In the countryside, chaos breeds more chaos. And where does the fault lie here? Well, the French might claim that if it weren't for all these damn resistance fighters or the pesky meddling of other communist countries, if these people just behaved and accepted their lot, then everything would return to a system of relative prosperity. Which would be nice for the French too, as these territories and people were basically seen as a way to make money. However, there was a growing number of Cambodians, and Sa was certainly one of them, who viewed the French to be the root of the problem. And if there were no French, then there would be no war, and therefore this period of insecurity would end. Again, it's here where we can fairly easily imagine the way in which the French presence at this point was now stoking the fires of nationalist energy. And for groups like the Viet Minh and those Cambodians associated with them, this was also providing this blanket of imperialist oppression that could be used to cultivate the political energy of communism. For Salat Sar, he was buoyed by this mix of nationalism and the ideas he had formed about communism in his time in Paris. He was a committed revolutionary, and he had returned to both his home country and his hometown because he was on a mission. Just a couple of months prior to his return, Sa and a handful of other young committed Cambodian communists had met in a farmhouse on the outskirts of Paris. Some of the more senior members of the Marxist Circle, as they called themselves, or they used the French. I'm going to use it in English from now on. Apologies. Anyway, the senior members like Yang Sari and Tian Mum, they remained in France. They kept doing what they were doing. But Sa, as he had links to the royal family, as well as having met with Son Yuk-tan on a few occasions, well, he was chosen to investigate the different independence factions and compile a report to be sent back to the students still in Paris. The Marxist Circle was looking to enter the picture here and actively support Cambodian independence, but they needed info about which team was the best one to get behind, essentially who they should, you know, invest in. Saar was the first to be sent back, but soon others would follow, especially once Sihanouk, as part of his general crackdowns on dissent to his rule, began cancelling the kinds of scholarships that had allowed many of these young Cambodians to travel to and stay in France in the first place. Articles in student newspapers protesting the king's seizure of power in the second half of 1952 were naturally going to be frowned upon, and soon the Khmer Student Association itself was banned in Paris. Now, Saar's return to Prakspar, apart from being something fairly natural to do for a young man of 28 when coming back home after a lengthy period abroad, well, it also allowed him to contact his elder brother, Salok Chai. There always seems to be some abundance of connections that this family is able to maintain with different parts of Cambodian society. Or perhaps it's just a result of the society itself, that small world feeling you get when looking at this history sometimes. Anyway, his older brother, by this point, had managed to be appointed as one of Son Nyok Tan's representatives. So, Saar had this conduit to the former Prime Minister, who was in the jungles of northern Cambodia. Remember, he had come back from exile in France with Sihanouk's blessing, and then just, you know, hung around for a bit before making this elaborate move to the Marquis in the hopes of uniting the entire Issarak movement, as well as incorporating the Khmer Viet Minh into this one solid anti-French entity. This hadn't quite gone to plan. Some Issarak remained united, some didn't, some with the Viet Minh, and some against. Tan's attempts simply pissed off Sihanouk to a great extent, and added another chef to the already crowded kitchen. Anyway, out of the three factions that Saar had been sent back to investigate, it would not be his idol Son Nyok Tan that he would go and visit first, but rather one of the old-school Issarak that we introduced a couple of episodes ago, the rebel prince Chantarangzi, who was Sihanouk's cousin. Chantarangzi was described as one French commander as a true feudal lord, and commanded a rather large section of Cambodia in and around the southwest of the country, around Kompong Spu. The prince wanted independence, but was not a communist, so this put him in the nationalist side of the Issarak side of the equation. This was actually kind of handy for the French, because while they couldn't control that area itself, at least it meant that the Viet Minh weren't controlling it either. Now, the rebel prince, as I've been calling him, oversaw about 1,000 troops, but they weren't exactly the most exquisite soldiers around. One young student recruit remembered them as being fairly loosely structured and not very well commanded. Basically the kind of guys where if there wasn't a war on, well, they were going to go straight back to being highwaymen again and robbing people during the night. Basically a bunch of bandits and mercenaries living in a camp of thatch huts. Saar was less than impressed during his time with the rebel prince, and after a few months found himself back in Phnom Penh. It was there that he met up with Ping Sai, another former classmate who was on a similar mission for the Marxist Circle. He had gone to the northern jungles to secure information about Son Nyok Tan, whose group included some Cambodian students who had also been regulars of the student association meetings back in Paris, namely Ia Sichao. Ping Sai had proposed that the Marxist Circle might be able to act as a connection between the nationalists under Son Nyok Tan, what he had termed the Khmer Sarai, or Free Khmer, and those Cambodians who had thrown their lot in with the Viet Minh. However, because the returning students were, generally speaking, communists, and likewise the Khmer Viet Minh, there was always going to be this incompatibility. The Son Nyok Tan nationalists were not communists, and they wanted to be in control. Whereas naturally the Khmer Viet Minh were going to be aligned with Vietnam and taking orders from the East, the proposal made by the students came to nothing, and was indicative of the same struggle that Son Yat-Thanh had with trying to unite the whole resistance movement the year before. Too many factions had their own goals and values, despite all wanting independence. Ping Sai explained to Salat Sa that although the Thanists in the jungle have some good attributes, they are less battle-hardened than the communists. They rely on Issarak guerrillas who have just been content to stay in the forests for years without troubling the French that much, whereas the Khmer Viet Minh were genuinely fighting. Rat Sam Wen, the close associate of Yang Sari and another committed student communist, also confirmed this when he tried to solve a similar problem with Ia Sichao when they had talks in Phnom Penh a bit later as well. The same disagreements came up, which must have been fairly, you know, reminiscent of the arguments that these same politically minded students were having, you know, a year or two ago during their study sessions in Keng Van Sack's apartment in Paris. With this new information about the prospects of Son Yat-Thanh and his Khmer Sarai, Sa began work on his report back to the Marxist circle in Paris. It was fairly straightforward for him to dismiss the old school Issarak as a potential force for his enthusiastic comrades to support. Sa viewed the rebel prince and his followers, as well as generally the rest of the Issarak, as a bunch of barely organized bandits. More than that, he also included in his report the way that Chantarangzi's forces were being used by the French as a kind of rudimentary countermeasure to Viet Minh encroachment. So basically, not them. Cross them off the list. Sa went on to explain that it would be also unwise to look at Son Yat-Thanh's group as the most promising avenue toward independence. Despite having some connection to people across the country, the former Prime Minister's attempt at becoming a serious contender to challenge the French hadn't been great. Sa wrote, quote, "His forces claim to be resisting the French colonialists, but in fact they do nothing. They just stay in an isolated mountain area in the north." He went on to conclude that the most promising group would be the Khmer Viet Minh, who, through their alliance with the Vietnamese, could claim support from the world communist movement, and therefore the only serious faction to have international connections. Sa sent his report back to Paris, and it's interesting for me here to look at him at this point. Now, some kind of line has been crossed, hasn't it? There is, perhaps patronizingly on my behalf, this view I have of him and the other students as more or less playing at these early points, like talking the talk, reading the books, members of various communist groups and parties, you know, having their secret selves and their meetings. But there's something more real about going and being on the ground there, taking it upon themselves to investigate and begin trying to insert themselves onto the situation in some way. Anyway, what's important to remember as this report finds its way back to the think tank of the Marxist circle back in Paris is that one of the overriding aims of this young Cambodian communist group is to have a high degree of autonomy in relation to the Vietnamese. This is something I know I've tried to stress throughout the series because I want it almost to be in the back of your mind in the same way that it was for these young students and indeed for many Cambodians. They always had this degree of mistrust toward their eastern neighbor. If these Cambodians want independence from the French, you bet they also want that to mean independence from Vietnam. And yet, they are faced with a scenario where the only viable example of fighting the French is through the same means as the Viet Minh. And realistically, they will require their help. This was one of the considerations that created the need to send back students like Saar to see if there were other options available. And his report was considered at length by those back in Paris in various meetings. As one of those members of the Marxist circle remembered, quote, "We all agreed that Cambodia had to be free of the Vietnamese. But the question was whether we should try to wrest control from the Viet Minh by working within or externally. If we'd done it from the outside by joining forces with Son Yat Thanh, it would have meant fighting them and sacrificing a lot of Cambodian lives. Whereas if we were working within the Viet Minh movement, we could do it gradually. Fewer people would die. So we decided to support the Viet Minh, while at the same time trying, little by little, to free the Khmers in that movement from Vietnamese tutelage. That was the decision that we took in Paris." End quote. That's a big deal. There is a lot in there. This sets up a lot of things to come. Remember, all of the early Cambodian communists, your Thu Samuts, your Son Yoc Mins, they were all imported into the Indo-Chinese Communist Party via contact with the Vietnamese. This new, younger generation of intellectual communists that had, you know, plied their trade in Paris, well, they had a rather different initiation into this ideology. But even from this early juncture, the only way forward was to throw their lot in with the hereditary enemy, but with some vague goal of achieving independence from them, as well as relying on them for the time being. And this was the way forward for Salot Saar, utilizing the connections available to him via his brother to that Son Yoc Thanh network, which was in contact with the Khmer Viet Minh on the eastern side of the country. Saar was able to arrange for he and Rat Samoan to be assigned to a handler who would be able to take them to Prey Veng and into resistance headquarters. Saar had been on this mission back in Cambodia for more than 6 months, and he was now going to take another massive step forward on this revolutionary path when he and his comrade, without telling friends or family, disappeared into the night from Phnom Penh and onto the back roads towards the so-called liberated zone. Salot Saar was joining the Maquis. In the first 9 months of 1953, an extremely important year for Cambodian history, we've traced Salot Saar's movements from Paris to Saigon, from his home village to Phnom Penh, and into various areas of Cambodia on his mission for the young communists who wished to guide their country into independence. But if we consider their efforts to be something secretive and done in the shadows, well, then we have another example of what could be considered the same mission, however, done in the most attention-seeking and intensely visible way imaginable. A series of steps that could really only be taken by someone whose confidence stemmed from somewhere unknowable to the average person. In the words of Milton Osborne, someone who became convinced that he and he alone possessed the capability and the right to determine his country's future, King Sihanouk. The man who had been imbued with the constitutional powers to dissolve the country's parliamentary process and declare martial law, he had gone ahead and done so. And in January of 1953, he even jailed a dozen or so of his opponents in the Democratic Party, naturally without trial. He had been concerned that they were plotting against him, that they were perhaps even going to declare a republic somehow and abolish his monarchy. And this was compounded by the traitorous actions of the returning Son Yoktan. And all of this had made quite a large impact on King Sihanouk. As we saw at the end of the last episode of the series, Sihanouk had declared that he would bring independence from France, and it wouldn't be the Tarnists or the Issarak in the jungle, not the Democrats in Phnom Penh. It was going to be him. He was going to get independence for Cambodia. And now we will trace the steps of his so-called royal crusade for independence. Because, as Milton Osborne also says, quote, "For all its theatricality and the highly favourable comments Sihanouk makes on his own endeavours, what he managed to accomplish between February and November 1953 was a remarkable achievement." End quote. I think it is fair to say that the initial steps that Sihanouk takes on his royal crusade take place against a backdrop of chaos. In February of 1953, the same month that Tsar is arriving back to his hometown and sorting out accommodation with the rebel Prince Chenturangzi, at the same time where Issarak or Viet Minh were occupying large areas of Cambodia with a now defunct political system dissolved by the king himself, and the French are struggling to continue fighting a war that has now gone on for like 7 years. Well, you'd think with all of that in mind, it might be a strange time for the monarch to declare that he was going on holiday. Something that will actually happen again and again in this series, by the way. Sometimes it will be under the guise of needing medical treatment or just a plain old holiday. But Sihanouk loves a trip to do some political maneuvers. Now, we should say at this point as well, the French take him at his word. They don't mind him going on holiday. And they're also pretty cool with him taking control of the country in the way that he has. I mean, they're still pretty much in control of the important things, according to them. And they don't put much stock in his rhetoric about independence. They're happy to have an authoritarian king in charge if it means keeping those pesky agitators in line for the time being. The French didn't like or trust the Democratic Party, just like the king didn't. That being said, they probably didn't quite expect what Sihanouk was going to put into motion over the next few months. The king arrives in the southeast of France, having left an entourage of his trusted advisors in charge back in Phnom Penh, a group that I should add contains his cousin, Sirik Mattak, and a senior member of the Cambodian army, Lon Nol. We will get to know both of them more throughout the series, but anyway, Sihanouk arrives in France and prepares for his first exchange with the French. Pen to paper, he addresses a letter to French President Vincent Auriol on the 5th of March 1953. The letter outlined Sihanouk's position along the lines that he enjoyed a great deal of popularity in his country and the fact that France still controlled the most important aspects of the nation, like the judiciary, the military, and economy. Well, this meant that the Cambodian government would always lack credibility. He said that if he were granted these aspects of rule, it would then be prudent for Cambodia to lean back on France for aid in the future, therefore not cutting them out of the picture. And this would allow a future Cambodia to avoid republican or communist movements that would destroy the monarchy.
Sihanouk said he would be happy to send advisers to Paris to discuss this further, or would welcome a visit with the president himself. He's basically saying, look, if you turn all the actual power over to me, I'll be cool with you guys after, and we can still be friends, and economically, things won't change too much, yeah? Alright, click send. He's awaiting a reply. In what must have been the 1950s equivalent of having a message marked as seen or read for some number of days, by the French president, no less. Well, weeks with no reply, Sihanouk gets the pen out again. This time with a bit more urgency added, with special attention paid to the military situation and the need for military powers to be passed over to the king. Him. This letter gets a reply. But it's the equivalent of, oh, hey, yeah, I just saw your message, but I'd been at work, I didn't have time to reply, sorry. The French president said that he had passed on the letters to his government for them to discuss, and that perhaps these issues should be discussed over a lunch, perhaps in a week. These are not great signs. Sihanouk got a lunch meeting 3 weeks after his initial letter was sent. I'll quote Osborne's biography about what happened next. Quote, that meeting brought no satisfaction. Moving first to Fontainebleau and then to the luxury of the Hotel Carillon in the heart of Paris, Sihanouk continued his offensive, but to no effect. Instead of progress as a result of further arguments submitted to the French, Sihanouk was now shown a glimpse of the mailed fist that his interlocutors had previously hidden behind the velvet glove of respectful words and courtesies. When the French commissioner for the Associated States, Jean Letourneur, came to call on Sihanouk, he told the king that his actions were inopportune. Since Sihanouk's compatriots obeyed him without question, all that was needed was for the king to be reasonable, and the problems he had raised with President Auriol would disappear. End quote. This attempt at placating Sihanouk would not work, and it was a misjudgment of the confidence that the king now possessed, particularly when it was doubled down upon by the French commissioner when he learned that Sihanouk intended to take his crusade for independence to an international audience. He reportedly had a message sent to the king explaining that if he did not show prudence on his travels in North America, then his crown could be at issue. This is quite the threat, by the way, and it left Sihanouk in a rage and onto the next step of his royal crusade. In the last episode, we spoke a little bit about developments in the Cold War, especially relating to the United States' policy of containment. And by the time that Sihanouk was coming to visit the US to make the case for the complete independence of Cambodia, well, there was now a set of principles, a rulebook, if you will, that foreign policymakers would be following for Indochina in relation to the Cold War. A 1950 report by the US National Security Council, literally called The Position of the United States with Respect to Indochina, contains a lot of this perspective and sheds some light on the prevailing attitude of policymakers. The report was prepared around the same time that the US recognized the Associated States of Vietnam, as well as Cambodia and Laos. And although the First Indochina War had raged on for another 3 years, we can gather from it the kind of rationale that Sihanouk was going to encounter on his trip. It also gives us some insight into an early formulation of the domino theory, which was the notion that all the nations of Southeast Asia were lined up like dominoes and that a communist victory in Indochina would lead to that red tide crashing over the entire region and signifying communist domination. The report also foreshadows US involvement in South Vietnam, as it explains the need to support non-communist nationalist leaders to satisfy legitimate nationalist aspirations of the people of Indochina, claiming that, quote, "The United States has since the Japanese surrender pointed out to the French government that a return to pre-war colonial rule is simply not possible," end quote. It also says that the newly formed states of Vietnam, Laos, and Cambodia do not yet have sufficient political stability nor military power to prevent the infiltration into their areas of Ho Chi Minh's forces. The French army, while apparently effectively utilized at the present time, can do little more than to maintain the status quo. Their strength of some 140,000 does, however, represent the only military bulwark in that area against the further expansion of communist aggression from either internal or external forces. End quote. And lastly, the report concludes that, quote, "It is important to United States security interests that all practicable measures be taken to prevent further communist expansion in Southeast Asia. Indochina is a key area of Southeast Asia and is under immediate threat." End quote. Now, as the French position had actually got worse since 1950 when this report was made, and the perceived threat of communism globally had followed suit, especially in light of the war that the US had fought in Korea, these practicable measures taken by the US had seen extremely large amounts of military and financial aid go towards the fighting of the First Indochinese War. The policy of containment and this early version of its Indochinese variant, that we will come to know as the Domino Theory, as well as the idea that the US had to kind of begrudgingly back the French in this conflict because there was no one else to back. That's a fairly cynical take, I guess you could say, or perhaps it simply follows the realist interpretation of international relations. But the US was okay with propping up the French in this instance, even though they disliked the idea of keeping an old-school colonial system running. But as long as it meant that it was going to halt the spread of communism, well, that was the main game, and the first order of business. The underlying feature of all of that being keep France in the picture if it means not losing Indochina to the communists, well, this is basically exactly what US Secretary of State John Foster Dulles tells Sihanouk when they meet to discuss the King's calls for independence. By this time, the king had realized that playing up to the idea of the threat of communism was going to be the best way for him to advance his cause. And while the Secretary of State was definitely not going to disagree that the communist threat was vitally important, well, they differed on the idea that giving Cambodia independence would represent the best way to fight its spread. As we saw in that policy report from years earlier, the US saw the French as problematic, if we were going to use a modern term, but the only bulwark against Ho Chi Minh. Dulles continued that line of thinking and told Sihanouk that without French military aid, Cambodia would simply be conquered by the Reds and would lose any independence that it would have gained anyway. There were a few effects of this rebuff, I guess we could say. Firstly, Sihanouk remembers these encounters with Dulles as pretty negative, as having been lectured to by the Secretary of State and not being taken very seriously. This culminated in the indignity of an aide suggesting to Sihanouk that a trip to the circus might be a good use of his free time during his visit in Washington. He was also not offered any invitation to meet with or dine with President Eisenhower. They weren't exactly laying the red carpet out for the Deva Raja. Instead, Sihanouk looks to the US media as a potential way to advance his cause, giving an interview to the New York Times where he claimed that if France didn't grant independence, then it would be they, not him, who would lose the region to the communists. And perhaps the Cambodian people would rise up and join the Viet Minh. This at least caught the eye of the French enough for them to resume negotiations with some of Sihanouk's advisers in Paris. It also taught the king that the foreign media could be extremely useful. However, one of the most enduring and important effects, particularly for our story of this trip to Washington in 1953, was the impression that Sihanouk walked away with. The feeling that US interests were harmful to his own, and by extension, his country. In the words of David Chandler, quote, "His estrangement from the United States had important effects on Cambodian history, none of them beneficial to the Cambodian people or to US policy objectives in Southeast Asia." End quote. Well, what was the king going to do next on this crusade for independence? He returned to Cambodia in May and received quite a welcome, although how much this reflected his people's adoration for him and his efforts, or how much was due to what I guess today we would simply call good PR, it's hard to say. Osborne suggests that despite his globe-trotting and letter-writing and interviews with politicians and journalists, there really hadn't been much tangible progress for this crusade thus far. Having arrived back in the capital, the king wished to distance himself from the French authorities there, so in a fairly royal gesture, he set up a headquarters in Siem Reap, near Angkor. This had the added benefit of placing him within a region of the country, militarily speaking, jurisdiction speaking, that had been ceded by the government to the Issarak defector Dapchuan, who was now enjoying a new nickname, by the way, Diamond Needle Chuan, which is, as you can tell, a cool name. Only weeks later, with negotiations stalling in Paris over this question of handing over military powers to Sihanouk in the regions that were still contested with the Viet Minh, the king decided to kick up a minor fuss by just turning up at the Thai border one day, crossing over with his entourage and beginning to issue more statements about the imminent need for independence to be granted. This doesn't impress the Thai, who are looking to keep a good working relationship with the French, nor does it impress the French, who see this as some ill-advised move to, you know, gain attention and force some breakthrough in negotiations by flipping the table over. But things were starting to happen, believe it or not. Rather quickly, this situation will transform. Firstly, the king's conduct was commented on by the French military commander in Cambodia, a General Pierre de Langlade, who coincidentally had trained the king at a cavalry school in France back in 1948. Anyway, he said that Sihanouk was a madman, but a madman of genius. A remark that Sihanouk adored for many years to come. But regardless of, you know, being styled as this genius madman, at this time, I mean, from a letter that Sihanouk drafted during this stay in Thailand, we can tell that he has a fairly good understanding of the situation that was facing Indochina. And it's worth quoting here because his self-styled, you know, Royal Crusade for Independence, through a mixture of his actions and the realities of the scenario the French were facing militarily, all of it's going to begin snowballing. But yeah, this, you know, letter he drafts in Thailand, if we give it a bit of a read, you can see his understanding of the situation is pretty spot on. It's written in the middle of 1953, and it's aimed at British and US diplomats. And I'll quote it at length here. I am asking the USA and Great Britain if, just for once, they will kindly consider the problem of Cambodia from the viewpoint of the Khmer instead of that of the French. My people will tell you, we don't know what communist slavery means, but the slavery imposed by the French, we know well. For we are now living under it. If we fight alongside the French against the Viet Minh and the Issaraks, we are simply strengthening the chains of that slavery. The problem is that in Indochina, you are either a communist or a lackey of the French. There is no middle course. We are not allowed to hope for an independence like that of India or Pakistan within the British Commonwealth. The question is, does French military power on its own have any chance of defeating communism in Indochina? To fight without having the native population on one side makes no sense. What is at stake in this struggle, and what will determine its outcome, is the native population. The Viet Minh have understood that from the start. If we who oppose communism wish to have the population with us, we must make our country's independence real and unquestionable, so that no one will listen any more to the Viet Minh propaganda about liberation. This is the whole problem. It is a political matter. It has nothing to do with the science of war. If France does not boldly face up to this, then one day, sooner or later, it will be forced to abdicate from Indochina. End quote. The king has a point, doesn't he? For instance, was it not ideas about liberating Cambodia from France that led many of the Parisian Cambodian students to look toward communism and the Viet Minh as the most viable path to achieve that goal? And the French, despite having a vastly superior military, well, they'd simply not been able to break the back of the Viet Minh. Philip Short, whose book I read that quote from, also notes that the inability of the US to be able to understand this idea will lead that country down a similarly tragic path over the next few decades. Something I've recently seen described as great state autism, this collective national inability to be able to perceive the realities of situations abroad. Well, so it goes. However, I believe it is worth noting at this point that the Sihanouk we begin to see in 1953 is something close to this fully formed Sihanouk that will provide a massive presence in the series going forward. And a much more mature actor than the Playboy King that surely some of the French authorities had still viewed him as. This is highlighted by the way the king kicks his crusade into high gear once he returns from his sojourn in Thailand on the 21st of June, in, as Osborne says, an angry mood. Frustrated by lack of progress in negotiations toward independence going on in Paris, as well as the unwillingness of powers like the US to take him seriously, and the French media portraying his demands for independence as laughable pretensions. Well, the Deva Raja that the French themselves had helped create began leaning on that magic, leaning on the crown, as it were. His proclamations begin to take on an air of sedition. In June, he told a visitor from the United States that as far as he was concerned, France was now Cambodia's enemy number one. At the end of the same month, he called into being a popular militia to, quote, defend the country against insecurity, the Viet Minh, and eventually against all foreign aggression. Now, if the French missed that subtle hint, he also said that if we cannot obtain what we want peacefully, the entire Khmer people are resolved to obtain their freedom by other means and are ready to sacrifice their lives. More than 130,000 poorly armed but enthusiastic men and women were assembled throughout the kingdom by the end of August. There also began large-scale desertions from Khmer units in the French army. The genius of a madman, perhaps. Sihanouk was pushing the envelope, even leaning into the picture of himself as someone perhaps becoming a little unhinged. But this posturing wasn't just for the French. Remaining Issarak forces or Son Yoktan's Khmer Sarai, even the Khmer Viet Minh, had to now look at Sihanouk as a formidable opponent. And it might depend on your perspective here, because it is kind of fun to imagine this Deva Raja pushed to the limit and beginning to call upon his people in order to push for independence, and the French being forced to concede to his and his people's wishes. A heroic king pulling his country free from the colonial yoke. Or one could also look to the French themselves, realizing the situation that they had dug themselves into. Quite literally in the case of Dien Bien Phu, but we will talk about that in the next episode. For instance, the same general that had described Sihanouk with his genius madman phrase also wrote home to authorities in Paris, explaining his dire predictions for the war, something he thought as hopeless. He said it would require far more men and firepower than what could be reasonably provided. France had been involved in an increasingly costly war for 7 years. The French public had lost its stomach for La Sarguerre. The dirty war needed to end. The French needed to find a way to get themselves out, while retaining some honour and not completely divesting themselves of their economic interests in the region. This would take time, and we're still more than a year out from the end of the war, but even though Vietnam was the real cause of all this consternation, Cambodia's irritating ruler is going to be able to advance his agenda. Sihanouk was pushing the envelope and now beginning to watch it bend. If his messages about rising up against the French or the numbers of young men and women that he had called to fight by his side were a bluff, well, it worked. The French could not afford opening up another front in the Indochina War, nor could they risk all of Cambodia falling completely to the Viet Minh. They saw that Sihanouk could not turn back now, and one French official said that history is on Cambodia's side. The French government, at the time briefly headed by Social Democrat Joseph Laniel, had announced that it would take steps to provide complete independence to the Indochinese states. And negotiations between each territory and the French took on a frantic pace as each side tried to get its best deal. It was at this point that Sihanouk became a legitimate rallying point for the majority of non-communist Issarak forces. All but the rebel Prince Chantarangsi and Son Yoktan's Khmer Sarai pledged their support to the king. Around the same time that young communist revolutionaries Salot Sar and Rat Samuen were planning for their trip to the liberated zone under the Viet Minh in the east of the country, negotiations in Paris edged closer and closer to granting control of the final parts of Cambodia's independence, control of the police, the judiciary, and full military powers. This was finally announced on the 17th of October, and agreement on all matters was completed. With his crusade now more or less complete, Sihanouk returned to Phnom Penh 2 weeks later to sign the documents himself. He was cheered along the route from Siem Reap to the capital by, as Milton Osborne puts it, hastily assembled crowds of his compatriots. This was his moment of triumph. A rebuff to Son Yoktan and all those who had opposed him during the years of unproductive parliamentary bickering. These assembled crowds, however, were described as completely delirious with this unprecedented triumph by royal propagandists. On Monday, the 9th of November, the formal declaration of Cambodia's independence took place, and the king had a kind of parade in the pouring rain in front of French and Khmer troops in Phnom Penh, the ceremony signifying the transfer of sovereignty. November 9th, now becoming Cambodian Independence Day. And in 1953, it ended almost a century of French control of the country. Sihanouk was officially made a national hero. And I mean a literal certificate saying he was a national hero. This was issued by, in the words of David Chandler, a quasi-legislative body made up of former members of the dissolved assembly, a document countersigned by Sihanouk himself, end quote. Always good to sign the document saying you are awesome. Anyway, wearing full military garb, the king met up with General De Langlade in the lead-up to the Independence Day ceremony. The general said to Sihanouk, "Sire, you have whipped me." And Sihanouk, responding to the man who had also bestowed upon him the phrase, "genius of a madman," Sihanouk says, "But no, general, I have followed as best I can the excellent lessons in tactics that you gave me. I have just behaved as a pupil worthy of General De Langlade." For Sihanouk, Cambodia's independence had nothing to do with what was going on in Laos or Vietnam. In his mind, and perhaps in the eyes of many around the country, the French had responded to his crusade precisely due to the now officially designated national hero's actions. Whatever the reality of the situation, there was something impressive to be seen here. In the words of Philip Short, quote, "At 31, he had proved himself a worthy successor to the long line of Khmer kings who, over the centuries, had made the preservation of an independent monarchy, indistinguishable from Cambodia itself, their overriding goal." End quote. But the war was not over. And although the country was officially independent, it was certainly not secure. The French were still fighting a war, and large areas of Cambodia were not under the control of Phnom Penh authorities. While many nationalists had pledged allegiance to Sihanouk, those fighting under the banner of communism were not reassured by this feudalist government in Phnom Penh, and their battle waged on. Before the final frantic months of Sihanouk's royal crusade, before this slightly unforeseen moment came to pass, Salot Sar and Rat Samuen, both members of this secretive Marxist Cambodian student group, as well as members of the French Communist Party, well, they had begun their journey to the Khmer Viet Minh Eastern Zone headquarters. It would have taken a couple of weeks walking through the forests with their Vietnamese guides once they had probably met up with them in a district in between Phnom Penh and Kampong Cham. After they crossed the Mekong, it would have been another 10 or so days walking in and around rubber plantations on the way through Prey Vang and toward the border of South Vietnam. Their destination was a village called Krabao. The Khmer Viet Minh encampment they arrived at was rustic in the extreme. It was in a semi-cleared-out portion of forest, where nothing permanent stood. The shelters were erected with canvas walls so they could be moved very quickly. Salot Sar and Rat Samuen were given a black shirt and trousers upon their arrival, as well as a red and white kramar. And I'm sure I've mentioned this on the show before, and naturally if you've been to Cambodia or you're Cambodian, you'll know what this is. But if not, a kramar is a kind of multi-use scarf that you see everywhere there. They also donned the so-called Ho Chi Minh sandals. These are made from car tires. Those of you even vaguely familiar with the story of the Khmer Rouge will no doubt be familiar with this same outfit. being described as the one war by those who silently marched into Phnom Penh in April 1975. It is also the uniform, I guess we could say, that essentially the entire population was forced to wear in the roughly 4 years that the party ran Cambodia. Another member of the Cambodian student group who would later join up with Sar and Samwen at this Viet Minh base said that everyone wore black, and that way you melted into the mass of the peasants and it didn't show the dirt on you either. And while it's obviously kind of fascinating to see this fairly iconic part of the Khmer Rouge imagery that we want to focus on, there's much more foreshadowing, I guess, if we want to call it that, that's going to come from this mission to the liberated zone in 1953. Now, remember, the students that are arriving here in this camp, well, they had just come back from a few years studying in Paris. You know, they'd had their little student meetings and they were reading all the literature and meeting with intellectuals and had begun considering themselves to be a kind of intellectual elite among their compatriots. And not without some reason either. They were extremely privileged to have been educated to the extent that they were, relative to your average Cambodian for sure. Now, if we mix that sort of elevated impression they may have had for themselves with the kind of, you know, mission that they were committed to, and the fact that they, you know, well, they were card-carrying members of the French Communist Party, right? Like, in our modern-day terminology, they would have presumed themselves to be pretty hardcore, right? And now they had come to the forests to prove it, in a way. You know, turned up with their credentials. I think you'll find that everything is in order and that I'm a pretty big deal, sir. They were probably rubbing their hands together thinking, what are we going to do first? Espionage? Sabotaging an important, I don't know, bridge? Infiltration? Propaganda? Well, not quite. Here is Sar's recollection of his early initiation into the Marquis. Quote, "As I had just come back from abroad, they didn't trust me. Almost everyone was Vietnamese. There was just a handful of Cambodians, and everyone spoke Vietnamese. They sent me to stay among the Cambodians. They didn't give me any kind of work to do. All I was doing was cultivating cassava, which is a kind of root vegetable. After a while, they let me work in the canteen. I was the deputy mess officer. The mess officer himself was Vietnamese. Even all the messengers were Vietnamese. The Cambodians were there in name only." End quote. Other members of the circle who arrived over the months that followed had similar grumbles, ranging from claiming that the Cambodians were being treated like puppets to exclaiming that the Vietnamese at the camp were all bastards. Mae Man recalled, "We spent our days watering the vegetables, feeding the chickens, things like that. It was because they didn't know who we were. They wanted us to prove ourselves." However, it would be unfair to characterize the Vietnamese to be patronizing these young revolutionaries just for the sake of it. They really did need to verify who these young recruits were and check their ties to the French Communist Party. This took time, but it was eventually ticked off. That being said, it would be probably going too far the other way to say that the Vietnamese viewed their Cambodian comrades as equals in this struggle. One could just look to how they organized their neighbors' resistance against the French, more or less without consulting them at all. This still had little impact on the revolutionary fervor that these new recruits had once they had joined up with the Viet Minh, though. After all, it was their initial goal to simply observe the so-called Khmer Viet Minh, to see just how much control the Vietnamese had over the movement. Salot Sar himself recalled that, "Although I saw the Cambodian movement was completely controlled by them, it did not shape my thinking to be anti-Vietnamese. I thought we should have a good relationship with Vietnam. I just wanted to make our movement independent." End quote. Anyway, we will see how that situation develops over the next 20 years or so. In the first few months of arriving, though, among the menial tasks they carried out, the students, fresh from Paris, also attended study sessions and began learning the kinds of lessons that separated them from the less hands-on approach to revolution they had been used to back in Yang Sari's apartment. These were the practical lessons that they had been missing out on. Philip Short points out some of the importance of this introduction of practical lessons for revolution, as well as the distinct Vietnamese flavour that was added to the growing list of ingredients forming the eventual communist recipe that the Khmer Rouge would be cooking with. As we went over in the last episode, Stalinism, Maoism, the French Revolution, as well as general Marxism, had become important lenses for the Cambodian communists to view the world through. The study sessions in the jungle at the Krabao camp were presided over by one of the earliest Cambodian recruits to the old Indo-Chinese Communist Party, Thu Samut, the former monk who had fled Phnom Penh after misplaced American bombs had landed near his monastery instead of the Japanese police headquarters toward the end of World War II. But the former monk, who was now head of the Eastern Zone quadrant of the so-called Liberated Zone, was just kind of there at the study sessions. The actual lessons were conducted by Vietnamese cadre from Vietnamese party texts, translated into Khmer. These sessions would start with a kind of six rules recital that simplified the goals of the revolutionary. And here they are. 1. Struggle all one's life for communism. 2. Put the interests of the revolution before everything else. 3. Uphold party discipline and observe the utmost secrecy about all party matters. 4. Carry out the party's decisions with an unshakable will. Never let oneself be downcast, no matter how great the obstacle. 5. Be a model for the popular masses. And 6. Study. Now, as Philip Short suggests, there isn't much in those six rules that gets across much of what we would consider orthodox Marxism. But we do get another reinforcement of secrecy, which is now becoming a thread through all of the influences upon the Khmer version of communist ideology and practice. It also had an anti-intellectual undercurrent. For instance, if a peasant or a worker joined the Cambodian Communist Party at this point, they would wait only 3 months before becoming party members, whereas intellectuals were required to spend 6 months and then be subject to a further 3-month probation once they were accepted as party members. So these are the kinds of early stages of development that will end up culminating in the ideas that underpin certain policies, I guess we could say, of the Communist Party of Kampuchea in later years. The mixture of indoctrination and terror was fundamental. Making propaganda means mobilizing the population to hate the enemy, a Viet Minh broadcast explained. Once people have the right feelings in their hearts, they will act accordingly. He goes on. One French officer wrote, "They, the Viet Minh, have succeeded because they have been able to channel the confused aspiration of the people, to fire their enthusiasm and to bring them hope. If the population refused to cooperate, a scorched earth policy was enforced. The village was razed and the inhabitants scattered." End quote. In the last episode, I referred to these different influences on the embryonic Khmer Rouge ideology like they were different components of a recipe. But in this instance, we could maybe look at this influence from the Viet Minh in the method, as opposed to the ingredients. So over these months, we have Sa in and amongst the Viet Minh camp, learning the ropes, helping out. But he and the other students were not going to, you know, go out on the kinds of operations that they were being taught. They themselves were not winning over locals to the cause or destroying villages that did not commit. Eventually, though, he will be allowed to visit these nearby villages that had been won over, where he will help out like a good revolutionary, you know, manual labor or farm work as required. Philip Short says that, quote, "This opened his eyes to the poverty of the border region and enabled him to see, for the first time, how the peasants adapted to life under a revolutionary regime." End quote. This, from a certain point of view, I guess, is invaluable experience for the young Pol Pot. And look at the difference there, with the difference in development, I guess we could say, between someone like Yang Sari, who was, you know, clearly in control of the Paris student group, was clearly the most, you know, educated in terms of, you know, Marxism, etc., genuine intellectual kind of thing, who saw himself as the future communist leader of Cambodia. But that was in Paris. Now this here, what Pol Pot is doing, or the man who will become Pol Pot, what he's doing in a clearing in the jungle, in what we could essentially consider a war zone, this is a bit more real, isn't it? And, just like that old saying goes, it's not sometimes what you know, but who you know. And Salot Sar is going to keep making contacts like he has throughout his whole life, but a few he makes during this time in the Marquis, well, they're going to go a long way in his eventual climb to the leadership of the Communist Party of Kampuchea. One of them is Kieu Mias, a Cambodian around the same age as Sar, who had joined the Viet Minh in 1950. He was even present at the, I'll say conference, even though that doesn't really fit, this meeting of what was still at the time the Indo-Chinese Communist Party. It was this meeting they had in Vietnam that we discussed in the last episode, where the Vietnamese outlined the path forward for the movement in Cambodia. Now, at the meeting, there was less than 25 Cambodians there to discuss the future movement in Cambodia, but some of them that were, we've identified previously, like Son Yoc Min, who ends up becoming the leader of it, Tu Samut was also there, and Kieu Mias, as we've said. Now, he and Salot Sar, although they're at similar ages and they're both involved in this movement, they certainly represent different paths to similar ends. Sar coming at this from his time in Paris, and Kieu Mias more homegrown, I guess we could say. And he had solidified his position with the communists. He had even travelled to Beijing and was the first Cambodian to meet Chairman Mao. He had a high status, and Sar worked under him, helping with writing scripts for a kind of revolutionary radio station called Voice of Free Cambodia. Now, this young and up-and-coming Kieu Mias also represented something of a rival for the young Pol Pot, although this will become more apparent later in the story. Now, another important member of the movement, as we said, the leader of the Eastern Zone, was the aforementioned Tu Samut. The former monk actually starts to take a liking to Salot Sar after noticing the new recruit had worked very hard to try and learn Vietnamese. Philip Short suggests that perhaps the fact that Sar had also spent time in the monastery as a boy, probably not too far from where Tu Samut was in Phnom Penh, perhaps this led to a kind of bond between the two of them. And soon Sar began to work as the Eastern Zone leader's assistant, helping him with his political seminars and establishing himself as his secretary and primary aide, a position he will hold for the next 5 years and pave the way for him to become the leader of the Cambodian Communist Movement. Sihanouk's royal crusade for independence had come to an end in November of 1953. But what next? Well, as we touched on earlier, the Indochina War itself was far from over, but the king's actions had consequences for those parties still involved. Firstly, nationalist Isarak forces, like the rebel Prince Chantarangzi, they eventually pledge allegiance to the throne, meaning that those not aligned with the communist Khmer Viet Minh had little to do except make common cause with the king. The only one that didn't was Son Yoc Tan's Khmer Sarai. So this left Sihanouk on one side, backed by the French, who were backed by the United States, against the Khmer Viet Minh, backed by the Vietnamese, who were in turn backed by the Chinese and Soviets. At this point in the war, in late 1953, the French had begun Operation Castor, which was aimed at preparing a massively fortified area around the region of Dien Bien Phu in northwest Vietnam. This initial operation was undertaken by around 10,000 paratroopers who flew into the area, equipped with bulldozers, in an attempt to capture a region around a former Japanese airstrip. Now, the battle that will ensue there over the next 6 months will become a centerpiece for the end of the First Indochina War, particularly as before the end of 1953, all of the different participants were fully aware that soon peace talks were going to have to start. And when that happens, everyone wants to get in the best possible position to start, you know, negotiating, to staking their claim on the final settlement. Dien Bien Phu will become the tug of war for the French and Viet Minh. But in Cambodia, Sihanouk and the Khmer People's Revolutionary Party will have a similar dance, one that the new king and national hero will want to jump into rather quickly, but they won't have a kind of famous showdown like in the hills of northwest Vietnam. The Cambodian army will begin attacking rebel bases around the country, and on one such expedition, the king himself will enter the fray. Operation Samaki, or Solidarity in English, was aimed at removing communist insurgents in the northwest around Battambang, and was, according to David Chandler, a 10-day exercise in public relations. Clad in a fresh uniform and in shiny combat boots, the king heroically led troops, sometimes on horseback, into danger across rivers, marching intrepidly through areas infested with booby traps and mines, braving the Viet Minh's craving to kill, on a mission to protect and free his loyal subjects from the whip and lash of communist slavery. Also, the official reports and photos in government publications would suggest. One of Sihanouk's most trusted military officials, Lon Nol, wrote up a report of the king's military skill that was full of lavish praise. Not going to do badly writing one of those up for your king, no, not at all. In reality, however, Sihanouk was not in any particular danger. This owing mostly to the fact that any Viet Minh in the area had already fled, and that the French had made sure that there was no threat within miles of the king. The Viet Minh did need to respond to the king's actions, however. His claim to independence in particular, as they now needed to portray him in the guise of a lackey, a puppet of the imperialists, who also must now be defeated. Sihanouk himself would find propaganda left behind in the villages that he heroically liberated in Operation Samaki. There he would find leftover cartoons, leaflets, that portrayed him as this puppet with strings controlled by the French. And much like his experiences in the US left him with a bitter impression of the West, so too would these cartoons form another experience which Sihanouk would interpret with a distrust and ire for those siding with the left in Cambodia. But these feelings will manifest later in our story, with a king who assumed that he had obtained a mandate to govern his country as he saw fit. He figured that someone who had heroically gone it alone and won independence could also rely on the same instincts and trusted allies to maintain the status quo that he would now decide upon. But that is for the next episode, as is the end of the First Indochina War, negotiations at Geneva, and the climactic battle of Dien Bien Phu. Now, I just want to thank everyone for listening once again. I realized whilst writing this episode that it is the 3-year anniversary of the show, which is wild. I want to thank anyone who has been listening from the start and waiting patiently for the show to get to the point that it, you know, originally set out to cover, as well as to all of the listeners who have jumped on over the last few years, and naturally the guests we've had on at this point as well, David Chandler, Tom Chandler, and Craig Etchison. I'm sure the show sounds rather different than it did in those early episodes, and it's certainly gotten bigger and longer than I ever thought it would. Thanks to everyone that has ever gotten in touch, left a rating or review, likewise on YouTube. A special thanks to anyone who has donated to the show. Really means a lot. But aside from that, I'm just so grateful that there are people out there that have connected with the series and what I'm trying to do with it. It does take a lot of my time and energy, but it makes me very proud to make and to know that at least some people like it. So, thanks again, and until next time, goodbye.